Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyper-connected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I'm your host today. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata & Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at GE. And prior to that, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today is Rita McGrath, who is perhaps the best person with whom to have a discussion on how our world is changing in very profound ways. Rita McGrath is a best-selling author, she's a sought-after advisor and speaker, and a longtime professor at Columbia Business School. She's one of the world's top experts on strategy and innovation, consistently ranked among the top 10 management thinkers in the world, including the number one award for strategy by Thinkers50. Rita's recent book on strategic inflection points is Seeing Around Corners, which is exactly what we need to do now. How to spot inflection points in business before they happen. She's also the author of four other books, including the best-selling The End of Competitive Advantage. Rita, it's such a great pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's so lovely to be here and to be with your readers and listeners.
Anything else you want to say about yourself? We could just talk about your bio for an hour, but anything more that you think is relevant to our conversation and our listeners should know?
Oh, well, I was once voted one of the 25 smartest women to follow on Twitter.
That's pretty impressive. That is pretty impressive. I would actually rank her as one of the 25 people across genders and every other classification. So let's kick it off, Rita. Today we're going to tackle some very big themes. But with you, given your experience and your prominence as a business advisor, we're also going to do it from a very pragmatic angle. So let's start with the main big idea for our discussion. You've been arguing that the world has reached an inflection point and that we are now in the midst of a transition towards a very different world. Can you tell our audience in what ways you think the new world is going to differ from the old one? What are we leaving behind and what are we going to?
That's a great question. So this is all based on the work of Carlota Perez, who is a Venezuelan economist who studies really long cycles in capitalism. And it's a very good inflection point story because what she argues is that there are some innovations that are so profound that they change not only what's technologically possible, but they change the society that is based on these technologies. And so we're coming to the end of this whole consensus around mass markets, which was, you know, initiated by the development of the assembly line. Ford's assembly line was the revolution there, but also cheap energy, so fossil fuels, which then allowed us to build suburbs full of houses, full of appliances, highways, air travel, you know, that whole kind of 120-year-long sort of stretch from the early 1900s to today, really based on those fundamental technologies. And what Perez argues is that these phases in capitalism almost look like an S-curve. So there's a period, and I would say, you know, sort of 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, there's this period of steady productivity growth where everybody's benefiting, productivity is going up. There's a potential for a golden age, you know, workers benefit from the riches that are created. But what happens with those those technologies is eventually, you know, people have bought all the appliances they need to buy. The growth and the productivity development start to slow down because that era is kind of getting exhausted. And what happens when that happens is capital goes looking for the next big thing. And in our specific case, capital's found digital. You know, the invention of the microprocessor in 1971 sort of coincided with the beginning of this sort of flattening out of productivity increases from the petrochemical fuel cycle. So where we are now is in this transition. We are moving from this world that we kind of understand and know, which was based on things like free trade, you know, globalization, the kind of Thomas Friedman, the world is flat, that sort of set of assumptions, into a world which is much more digital, where we're buying more services and fewer goods. This idea of dig stuff out of the ground, make something with it, use it, and then throw it back in the ground in the form of land waste. You know, that's really not going to be viable. Clearly, our dependence on fossil fuels has all kinds of negative effects. And eventually, we're going to run out, you know? So we need to invent different ways of energy. And so there's a whole kind of sociological and technological revolution, but we're right in the middle of it. So the old thing hasn't quite gone away, and far from it, right? And the new thing hasn't yet really become widespread enough to radically change our lives. Now, we can begin to see the early warnings of what's coming. And I think one of the big things I'm looking at right now is dematerialization. Things that used to require a physical object, and probably music would be the easiest way to understand this, right? You used to have to buy records, and then you used to have to buy CDs. You paid for 18 songs when you really only wanted one. Today, you don't even buy music. You rent it. It flies through the air and lands on some device. That whole set of things in between, the record player, the music player, the boombox, whatever it is, that's all gone. And you got it all on one device, which has also replaced all these other things, you know, flashlights and listening devices and cameras and who knows, all in your smartphone.
Yeah, we've gone through all those. Let me stay on this specific topic for a second, because it makes me think of where the next big breakthrough is needed. When you talk about the dematerialization of things like music, for example, what you said is absolutely correct. The one material link that remains is energy, because we can do it immaterially, as you've described, but there are servers somewhere being cooled and consuming more and more energy. So would you say that at this stage, to proceed towards this dematerialization trend, energy, both energy generation and energy storage breakthroughs will remain probably the key issue to look at?
I think we're seeing a huge amount of activity around that. Absolutely. Energy storage in particular is quite a thing, because, you know, the sun doesn't shine all day long and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So if you can't store that energy, you can't really rely on it. The other thing, and I was talking to somebody in the military the other day, and one of their big concerns is if you've got, you know, fleets or vessels or something, oil is a fantastic material for energy because it's portable. It can come with you. But if you have to rely on distributed energy sources, that poses remarkably complex problems. So unless you can get a battery or something that stores energy that is functionally equivalent to what, you know, gasoline does today, you're going to have to completely rethink how you power, you know, armed vehicles, for example.
No, that is exactly right. In fact, let me take a step back now. When you were giving your view, the broad view of how these big changes are taking place, I loved it because you're bringing together the initial impulse, which is the technologies, changes in technology, which when they become disruptive enough, then have big impact on reshaping our economy and our social structure. Now, on the economy, that's one area where, of course, I get very excited. And I'm thinking of the following. Part of what's been happening over the past couple of decades, at least, is financial flows in our global capitalist system have become dominant. I mean, I remember, for example, when I started working at the International Monetary Fund back in the early 90s, the IMF used to be the only game in town, in the sense that if a country was in trouble, it only had the IMF to provide funding. Then private financial markets became so big that the IMF has become virtually irrelevant. Now, this dominance of financial flows creates almost two sides to the story. One is the risk of financial bubbles. We're always worried, you know, we look at the stock market and we wonder, is it a bubble? Is it going to pop? Is it going to be a disaster? The other part, though, is how capital gets allocated in the economy. So these financial flows are financing investments. So there seems to be a trade-off between cycles of hype and excitement and therefore the risk of bubbles, and on the other side, the investment, the funding and investment that actually goes into innovation and technology and fuels these changes you were talking about. How should we think about this balance?
Well, the bubble part is absolutely predictable. And what Garlotta would tell you is it's an essential feature of capitalism. It's not a bug. So what happens during the bubble period? And I think if you use the dot-com bubble just as a case in point to make it memorable for people. What you had throughout the 90s was this incredible investment in infrastructure for the internet. You know, all you had to do was say, oh, I've got an internet business model, and venture capitalists like throwing money at you. So it built out our technology infrastructure. It built out things like optical cables under the sea. It built out the capacity for high-speed broadband, which everything else depends on. And now when the bubble burst in 2001, most of the investors lost their shirts. I mean, you know, even really famous investors like Fred Wilson lost 90% of his wealth. But here's the thing. Once the bubble bursts, what it leaves behind is this infrastructure, you know, the broadband cable, the infrastructure of computers on every desk. And what then happens is capital kind of gets whipsawed, right? It gets extracted from this kind of casino-like bubbly economy. And now it has to partner with the real economy to produce real productivity gains. And the financial guys hate this because, you know, during the bubble, you can make tremendous amounts of money just, you know, on the ebbs and flows of capital. When you have to start putting that capital to work in the real economy, the outrageous returns become less likely. But what you're building now is real returns based on real business models. And what capitalism does is it seesaws between the two.
No, that is, it's excellent. In fact, it's something that I was looking at very deeply when I was working at GE, because that was exactly our concern, right? Becoming a digital industrial company, we were caught in between. So we did not benefit from the excitement of digital companies, but we kept saying, look, it's different because eventually these digital technologies need to get traction and align themselves with the physical world. This is what we're trying to do, but it's harder and it's slower. So it's an excellent point. Rita, we're talking about something that a big transition that probably also involves a change in the nature of the capitalist system as we know it. And it's in line with what you were saying earlier. Previous transitions in technology have also led to different economic models. So I'm curious if we can unpack a bit the kind of changes we can expect in our economic system. And my first question, partly driven again by my own experiences, do you think big corporations still make sense?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because with the advent of digital technologies and most recently with the advent of AI, what we're increasingly seeing is the unit of value creation is small teams or even individuals. And what we're seeing, it's ironic to be talking about this in a show based on ecosystems, but you could envision the equivalent of today's large companies being these constellations, these ecosystem connected constellations of much smaller groupings. Because what we're also seeing is, you know, back in the day when you were Whirlpool making refrigerators, right, your competitive advantage came from either scale. So, you know, you rounded off the cost of doing these things over, the more that you could sell, the better. So you had scale economies, or scope. So if you sold refrigerators, you also sold washer dryers, and you also sold things where you could use a similar capability set or whatever. And that favored large corporations who could do things with high quality in a mass market sense. There was such demand that, you know, if you made refrigerators, you were pretty much going to sell everyone you could make. And that was a very mass size company favoring sort of arrangement. In today's world, I don't know that we're going to need those massive companies, because what we'll have is products that are not only personalized, but customizable. So you might have a million, I'll call them washer dryers, but if they're digitally equivalent of a digital equivalent, each one could be tailored to what each individual user wants or needs. So I think the rationale for having these big giant companies is much lower than it was. Now, a couple of other things that I think are important for people to understand, because these things stretch across an individual human lifetime. So nobody living today really remembers a time before we had the kind of corporate law that we have today that favors the publicly traded, generally accepted accounting principles, you know, run company, where it was mostly around the ownership of assets, right? Today, the value represented by today's large publicly traded companies, only about 20% to 30% of what creates their future value is represented by physical assets. The rest of it's all intangible and digital. And that, to me, implies we're going to need a different kind of corporate charter, if you will. So, you know, we're not setting up railroads anymore, or maybe we are, but they're very different kinds of railroads than we used to have. And if you think about our labor systems, right, our labor system, a lot of our assumptions about how we manage employees are based on an employer-employment relationship, which is relatively durable. All of our labor laws are around that relationship, right? So we've got to rethink, what does health insurance mean for a gig worker? What does it mean when I may be a creative person, I may interact with 5 organizations in the course of a typical week? I may not be an employee. I may be a unit of one value creator, and I lend my services to other firms. So I've thought for a long time that we're increasingly moving towards a model where the way that we provide goods and services in the economy is much closer to the way we make movies than to many other models. So if you look at a movie, a big release movie, and you sit down in the movie theater and the credits start rolling, and it's like 5 minutes in because they've got 55 different logos and brand names. And these guys all come together to create a product, to create this project. And it's not a hierarchy, you know, and it's not a classical sort of organization at all. It's much more of an ecosystem of people who have bring to the table these different skill sets and so forth. So I think it's a really interesting question to think about. Do we need ExxonMobil sized companies in the future?
It's fascinating. And also a lot of what you're saying, Rita, seems to converge towards the idea of flexibility, right? Because large companies have big economies of scale, but they become less flexible. Now, you mentioned in the case of publicly traded companies, you mentioned the fact that now a lot of their value is based on intangible assets rather than tangible assets. There is also, thinking of listed companies, another change we're seeing in financial markets, which is fewer companies are actually getting listed, right? So we're seeing a decline in IPOs. We're seeing the importance of public markets declining. We're seeing more privately held companies, and we're seeing the rise of private credits and private equity. So more flexible forms of financing for companies. Now, this also has implications for how pensioners, savers, households access the financial benefits of investing in these companies. But there is something else there that also points to companies looking for more flexibility. Is that right?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And if you think about some disruptive event that might be problematic, you've got two ways of dealing with it, right? The first is you can try to anticipate it and get ahead of it and hopefully prevent it if it's a negative disruption. The other way is you can build increased resilience so that, you know, if something does happen, you can adjust accordingly. And that's where the flexibility comes in. What I would observe is that most corporate leadership today overinvests in prevention and underinvests in resilience.
Interesting. That's a very interesting and very important point. Let me bring you back also here as we're discussing how the capitalist system, the market system is changing. Bring you back to the idea you mentioned at the beginning, which is the idea of dematerialization, because, you know, I am not really a fan of the degrowth idea that you hear in some circles that essentially we need to reduce economic growth. There's something very, very punitive about it, like the idea that we have to do penance and we have to become poorer and lower our living standards. And I find that uninspiring. But there is no doubt that the current model of economic growth, as you pointed out, is putting enormous stress on resources, sometimes to finance, to feed the consumption of actual goods. It's probably incurring now very rapidly decreasing returns in terms of how much happiness we derive from them. So you mentioned the switch to services, the switch to dematerialization. How do you see this evolving in terms of, I guess, how we as humans maintain higher and higher living standards while reducing the pressure on resources?
Sure. So if you think about, take a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, just as an example. And back in the 50s, right, this was a middle-class luxury item, right? This was something that if you aspired to it, you bought, you know, you bought Jell-O and you bought Kraft macaroni and cheese. And, you know, there was this whole kind of category of consumer packaged goods in the food area, which were considered to be just amazing, right? They were affordable. They were luxurious without any particular cooking skills. You could come up with consistent outcome all the time. It was, you know, considered to be time saving, such a boon. My point is just back then, those were considered luxuries. Along comes Julia Child and, you know, her group of people basically saying, ooh, that's not the way to cook. And so here today, what have we got? We've got, you know, organic, vegan, tofu that's been, you know, whatever. My point being, what's considered luxury today is almost like a throwback to much closer to nature, farm to table. Let's grow food close to where it's going to be consumed. Let's not truck it 3,000 miles. So in a way, what you've got is the leaders of the culture, right? The people who are declaring what is luxurious today, they're all about, oh, it's, you know, it's one cow and I know where the meat came from. I know the name of it. It's all traceable. It's all grown close to where it's going to be consumed. It's grown in organic fields. My point is, all that stuff, you know, back in the 1700s, that's what they had. They had organic, locally sourced grown food. And that sort of ensuing ways of capitalism sort of brought us this sort of food industrial complex that we have right now. But if you think about where the leaders, the thought leaders in culture are going, it's back to that natural all source.
But wouldn't you say on this specific example, Rita, couldn't you argue that it actually, that doesn't help us that much in reducing the resource footprint, in the sense that if all of us have to move towards locally sourced and organic food, we're going to have to expand the agricultural system in a completely different way?
You have to change it. You have to
change it.
So we're starting to see, I mean, even today, you know, here's some of the early warnings. We're starting to see vertical farms, you know, farms based in cities, in buildings. That is a sector. It's projected to grow really rapidly. Now, right now, you know, the best it can kind of do is lettuce and stuff like that. But it's, you know, they're learning every day. They're going to get better and better. So you're starting to see even in urban areas, you've got bees on the roof now. You know, you've got sources of nature sort of interweaving with the urban architecture now. You've also got these farms where they will sell directly to consumers, like on certain days of the year, that kind of thing. And you're also seeing the ability to create goods and materials with a much smaller footprint. So to go away from food for a minute and think about, let's say, auto production, right? I mean, we're used to thinking of scaled auto production as these long assembly lines, these huge buildings and everything. But Hyundai in Singapore has created a vertical factory to create cars. And they're essentially on-demand cars. So the car starts off in the first floor and it makes its way up this building with different robots tacking different things on it. And it's fascinating to kind of watch. And then by the time it gets to the seventh floor, there's a beautiful sort of drive and the car arrives on the seventh floor. The owner gets the keys and drives off down the building in a sort of a triumphant array. Now, why does this make any sense at all? Because Singapore is a high-cost country. Land is very scarce. You know, it's just got every conceivable traditional a logical argument about car manufacturing would rule this thing out. But if you think about it, Singapore has really high taxes on imported cars. So if it's made there, they don't have to bear that. Secondly, the cars are incredibly customized. And what Hyundai is betting is that eventually we're going to get to a stage where we won't actually own one kind of car. We will have access to various kinds of transport mechanisms. So you'll want something different if it's Saturday and you're taking your kid to their sports than if it's, you know, a holiday and you're packing your whole family in to go some distance, right? And you may conceivably just have access to a whole fleet of vehicles, which are managed in a radically different way than those that we manage right now. So I think the challenge for our imaginations is, and, you know, even with food, how do we rethink some of our assumptions about the way these systems work so that we can, you know, have a better life? And I'm with you. I'm not into the degrowth. You know, we must all cower in the woods and suffer. What was that old song about? Now we just eat nuts and berries, right? This was a parking lot. I think that world, that sort of dystopian world is what many people are going to voluntarily sign up for. And for a change like this to happen successfully, people have to feel it's better. You know, like processed macaroni and cheese was better than what we had before. And something more natural and local and whatever is better. We may also want to think about changing the pattern of demand. So I was talking to a guy that runs a supermarket. And he said, you know, when I was a kid, there were seasons for things. You know, you had strawberries at a certain time of year. He said, today what happens is just the price just changes depending on where they have to get shipped from. So we may be moving towards a more towards a greater appreciation of the seasonality of things and not just sort of have the commodity products available all the time, all year long. That may be something we're actually pleased about. You know, maybe it's something that's, ooh, it's strawberry season. That's special again.
No, it's a very good point. You know, I'm originally from Italy and often I go back. And when I go back, I'm from a small town in the center north of Italy. It's an area which has a strong agricultural tradition. And there you shift back to the idea of eating what is in season. And you learn to appreciate the pleasure of, oh, now strawberries are everywhere. Oh, now we have asparagus. And it actually gives you a lot more pleasure than having it available. You also come to realize that there is a trade-off between everything, having everything available always, and the quality. If it's available only when it's in season where you are, it tastes better. But Rita, the example you gave on vertical farming is exceptionally good. In fact, we had a podcast episode on this a few months ago. It's relevant also to, of course, space exploration. There is another element I wanted to unpack with you, which is very topical right now, and it's protectionism, right? You and I are recording this podcast just the day after Liberation Day, so the day after that the US government has announced these massive tariffs on almost every trading partner. And so this protectionism really seems to have come back in fashion. Everybody's talking about reshoring of manufacturing, self-sufficiency. I think there is also a more subtle shift happening, though. For one thing, this protectionist trend has been in place for a while, though not as dramatically as we have now seen. But something is happening. Part of it is the dissatisfaction with globalization that pushes this resurgence of protectionism and nationalism. And I would be curious to hear, why do you think this is happening? But secondly, I'm curious, from your perspective, how do you see the evolution of supply chains and production systems? Given we were talking before about the importance of ecosystems, how do ecosystems adapt to these challenges? And how does this change the distribution of economic opportunities within countries?
Oh, it's a fascinating topic. So I would say the roots of our current dissatisfaction with the way globalization has unrolled for many people really would begin with the ascension of China into the World Trade Organization, which I believe was 2001. Yeah. And what the prevailing belief in the US at the time, I mean, if you listen to the sort of newscasts at the time, it was all about, oh, this is going to be fantastic. China's going to have to play by the rules. It's going to march westward in terms of its philosophy and beliefs. It's going to produce greater prosperity, greater democracy. They're going to be great trading powers. It's such a huge market. You know, all the American companies are going to go into it. It's going to be China. And very few of those assumptions were actually borne out. So China did not exert a specific tariff in the form of a tariff. But if you wanted to do business in China, you may remember at the time, yes, you were required to give up IP, you were required to partner with local firms, you were required to, I mean, there was a whole long list of things that they wanted from the West, you know, large scale IP theft. I mean, this is no secret, right? Yes. And just basically taking the technologies. And people were willing to, you know, business leaders very consciously made some of those trade-offs because the rewards were so great for doing that. And I think this is a real failure in terms of the sort of West's way of negotiating with China. So as an individual company, right, you were required to have a China strategy. And so what ended up happening was a lot of labor, which up until that moment, people kind of thought of labor as a fairly fixed, locally bound thing, right? But once you had basically cheap global shipping, which was facilitated by the invention of the humble box, you know, the box that goes on, it can go from a ship to a box, to a truck, to a whatever. Once you had that, you could easily offload and unload ships. And that in turn meant that you could ship stuff from halfway around the world and sell it cheaply. So if you think about the traditional view of globalization, there were products and certain things that were not suitable, right? So anything that was low in value and really heavy and didn't have a lot of value at the other end, you would never subject to globalization. Well, once you have practically free shipping, then what happens, the knock-on effect, is then your labor markets become now vulnerable to global standards because you can manufacture anywhere in the world that it's cheapest. And so what happened basically was good paid American jobs, and, you know, I think many of them were farmed out to China, to Mexico, to other places. And so for a great many people, globalization was not great news. I mean, if you think about the globe in terms of humanity, yes, globalization lifted billions of people out of desperate poverty and produced a much more productive world economy. But when you think about the impacts at the local level, when the steel plant closes down or the glass factory goes out of business, there aren't jobs to replace those that were lost. And so there was a lot of sort of very localized damage that was done by this version of globalization. So I think what we're seeing now is a lot of reaction to that, which is, hang on, we want to do what's right by our own people. We want to keep the economic activity we've created for ourselves. This is fine for the big company, big countries, right? So if you're the US or China or India, you've got a huge local demand. I mean, it's going to be rough adjusting all those supply chains, and we'll get to the supply chain question in a minute. But, if you're Norway or Ireland or the Philippines or something where you don't have that, you're going to have to get very creative about how you create alliances. Whose sphere of influence are you under? Who are you actually going to be able to trade with? Because those countries can't keep their current standards of living without trade. They just don't have large enough domestic markets. So back to supply chains. Oh, one more thing on the globalization front and the protectionism front. Another thing that you'll see in these big transitions in capitalism is the countries that are the leaders will often shift. So if you think about the Industrial Revolution, that put the UK, Britain, I guess it would have been at the time, in the driver's seat for things like, global colonialization, a lot of things that we look at sort of askance today, but it put that country on top kind of economically. Its influence was tremendous. And the influence, changed country to country as these large technological shifts flowed through. So where we are right now, right, is China's made no mystery of its ambitions. It wants to be the dominant global power. So does the US, perhaps. Mm-hmm. India, open question. So we're in this sort of moment where who's going to be the dominant country is kind of up for grabs. And that will also show up in things like protectionism and not wanting to be too open. In terms of supply chains, we're already seeing people are willing to give up those last few pennies of supply chain optimization to build more supply chain resilience. And I'm seeing people picking up plan B, C, D. And we're also using new technologies around supply chains in a really clever way. So to go back to my buddies at Kraft Heinz, one of the clever things they've done is they've created a digital twin of their supply chain. And so if there's a disruption in the real world, so say a port gets closed or there's a strike or a supplier doesn't deliver, what they do is they feed that data into the digital twin using AI. And what the AI then does is it runs through every possible response that the supply chain could make to that event. It says, okay, based on the parameters you've asked me to optimize, this is the course of action I would recommend. And now that digital solution can find its way back into the real world. And that's the choice they make. No human being could run through that much, computations and variables in their own heads as quickly as the AI can.
Exactly. It's an excellent example of a strong application of AI. And based on this, here is where I'm looking for some reassurance from you. So, you have outlined very clearly where we have failed to see the costs and risks of globalization and what the impact has been. However, you've also pointed out that globalization did have some very significant benefits in terms of economic growth, efficiency, cheaper goods. So does technology now allow us to regain, rebuild a lot of resilience with a moderate cost in terms of lost efficiencies? Because the concern otherwise is that as the world fragments and companies or governments try to achieve self-sufficiency or at least greater strategic security, and companies reshuffle and reorganize their supply chains for greater resilience, the concern is we will pay a high price in terms of more expensive goods and in terms of lower economic growth. So do you feel from your discussions with business leaders that technology can help us ameliorate this trade-off?
Oh, it absolutely can. It absolutely can. But what I think we need to get smarter about, and this is where I do have concerns, is we need, so if you think about the internet, right? What allowed the internet in most of the world, not in China, but in much of the world, what allowed it to be such a powerful force where there were standards bodies behind it, sort of saying, here's the rules of the road. Here's what a URL is. Here's how we know if you own it or somebody else owns it. Here's the property regime, right? So I think we need, call it a standard body for the global digital economy that you know, can be seen as respectable, fair, you know, a wise arbiter of choices, not victim to any one country or company, that would allow us to then have these digital goods be allocated in a more equitable way. So I think, yes, technology could be very powerful in helping us kind of operate in a resilient way without imposing a lot of costs. But I do think there's some missing ingredients, right? I think right now governments are not, if you look at the post-World War II way that governments constructed what happened after that horrible conflagration, America very consciously said, we're going to take the lead here, you know, Pax Americana. We're going to house the UN. We're going to invest in the Marshall Plan. We're going to rebuild our enemy, Europe. We're going to completely overhaul what happens with Japan to the level of actually installing a new constitution in that country. I mean, America was a very activist government in those days. And they were also, you know, guided by Vannevar Bush would be a great example, reported directly to Roosevelt, tying together this idea of military, science, the academies, you know, this sort of layer of knowledge. And very conscious decisions were made that America is going to give up some potential interest in order to have this dominant global power be the peacekeeper, kind of be the, you know, be the overall. And that was very consciously done. And what I'm not seeing yet is, where is the Vannevar Bush of our generation? You know, where is the, that wise sort of, let's look at things from a systems level and see how we want to tie these things together. So Bush was amazing. I mean, he was the one that actually was, you know, figured out that part of the problem with the way that we were fighting the Second World War was all these different innovators were operating in isolation from one another. And so what he did was he brought together the sort of theorists and the practitioners. He brought together the scientists and the artists, and he really had them problem solving together in ways that even today are just quite remarkable. And then he was instrumental in creating our great institutions, you know, Institute of Health, you know, National Science Foundation, all those things. And I think we're at risk of undermining that legacy without having anything yet that's clearly going to replace it.
It's a very important point, because it's even more important here now than it was back then, right? Because today, with the changes we've seen in technology, technologies have become much more interconnected. So has the economic system. The value that we find in innovation is more and more found at the intersection of different disciplines. And so having that broad look, that systemic look at how the world is operating, what we need to do, would be even more important today than it was back then. So if we're losing it now, that's a big problem.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree. Well, now, that much being said, I mean, I'm not saying those institutions need to be the way that they were originally designed. I mean, they're, what, 70 years old now. So it's not bad to have a period of re-examining and rethinking of something, because the world has changed. You know, that.
No, absolutely. In fact, I would say, I've been arguing that it would be surprising if institutions which were put in place 70 or 80 years ago were still good enough today. The U.S. Constitution is an exception, but international institutions, from the WTO to the IMF, to it, you can't expect them to function as effectively now, given how profoundly the world has already changed, without even thinking about how, as you said, it's changing going forward. On this one, Rita, another question I had for you is the following. In this transition, how do you see the evolution of the relationship between government and private sector, balance of power, division of labor, collaboration? How should we expect this to evolve going forward?
Well, we've had here in the U.S., we've had almost an anti-government ideology. I would date it going back to the sort of Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher era, where it was like, we want to shrink governments to be so small that we can flush it down the toilet. And I think that's short-sighted. And the reason is that capitalism doesn't have an ideology, right? Capitalism is a system in which capital gets directed towards wherever the people that have it think it can do its best use. And so that best use might be, you know, creating huge, large scale crematoriums for, you know, concentration camps, or its best use might be, you know, creating wonderful public spaces. I mean, capital doesn't have a thing. So what does government do? Government provides the guardrails, creates the rules, establishes the playing field on which capitalism operates. So if you leave capitalism to its own devices, right, what do you get? You get pollution, you get child labor, you get, you know, all kinds of things that as a society, we really don't want to be endorsing. So government needs to come in to create that sort of set of constraints under which capital operates. So I think a healthy respect for government and is really important. If you go back to the 1960s, 1970s, being a high-ranking government official was seen as something really honorable. You were serving your country. You were building the future. And I think since then, the reputation of government's kind of taken a hit. The public understanding of what government even does is kind of a mystery. Now, business people, they don't like taxes, right? They don't like having their, you know, the freedom to do whatever it is they want to do to be reined in at all. And so there's always going to be a tension, right? But I think the two sets of institutions need to respect each other. And I think they need to understand they have a different job to do. So when I hear people blather on about, oh, you know, government should be run like a business. No, they should not. Governments exist to perform completely different functions. In particular, governments exist to fill in the gaps when markets fail. You know, a lot of our big problems cannot be solved by market mechanisms. So I'll give you an example. Some years back, you may recall, there was this discovery that the ozone layer was shrinking, right? That there was a hole in the ozone layer was the way people talked about it. And no private sector company was going to solve that because the villain in this case were chlorofluorocarbons that bonded with oxygen and, you know, bonded with the ozone molecules to take them out of the ozone layer and do something else with them. It was government that signed the Montreal Protocol. It was every country on the planet signed this protocol, which is astonishing. And they basically said CFCs are no longer going to be a legitimate material to be used because the greater harm to the greater society is so extreme that we simply can't allow this anymore. And so I think government exists to say, this is where it's okay. You know, you want to compete like crazy on who's got the best video game or whatever, go for it. But if it's going to be a threat to, you know, our natural order, if it's going to create excessive amounts of risk and danger for people, if it's something that's really bad for human health or well-being, that's where we're going to say, no, you're not allowed to do that. So, you know, this goes all the way back to the tragedy of the commons, right? Where if you had a field and everybody's allowed to graze their cattle in that field, and in the short run, they might make a little bit of money, but in the long run, you lose the value of the field because it would be destroyed. And I think that's where government comes in.
Exactly. So what you're pointing to, Rita, is for me is we should obsess less about the size of government, wanting it very small or very large, and more about the quality of government, the focus on what it's supposed to do, the incentives, as you said, the old pride in serving your country. And you had mentioned earlier Singapore. Now, Singapore is also an example of a country where the government sector works spectacularly well. And so there are actually models around us that we could look at. So it's a very important point. Rita, the last question I would like to ask you and to explore with you is the following. Really, this really goes to another one of your points of strength in your recent research. We've discussed how the world is changing, what we're leaving behind, what we're moving towards, how and why. Now, when a transition like this one takes place, it will probably, one, take significant time to unfold, and secondly, as it does, it will probably change and evolve in ways that we can't yet completely anticipate. So what is a smart way to see, to identify the early warning signals, the signposts? What is a smart strategy to follow this transition along and be cognizant of the signals that tell us, here we have to pay attention, we have to shift in a certain way?
So I'm very taken with the work of the late Ari de Huys on this. He wrote a wonderful book called The Living Company. And he was at the time working with Royal Dutch Shell, which was one of the very earliest companies to take seriously this notion of scenario planning. And what he talks about is creating what he calls memories from the future, which I think is a fascinating,
wonderful concept,
isn't it? I know. And what he talks about there is he said, well, what you want to think about is imagine multiple possible futures. So the way our brains are wired is we tend to sort of start at point A and we think we're going to go to point B and then we plan for that, right? And that's not the way to plan for high uncertainty situations. What you want to be doing is saying there are multiple possible scenarios. right? And what I'm going to do is identify some of those, and then I'm going to work backward and say, before that thing could happen, what are some things I'd have to observe in the world, right, that would sort of alert me to the fact that this is becoming more or less likely? So let's take a specific example right now, autonomous cars, right? And what the whole world has done with autonomous cars is we've kept pretty much everything else about the car the same, except we replaced the driver. So it's still got four wheels. It's still as wide as two horses' butts, which is where the original width of roads and things came from back in the days of the Roman chariots, right? So there's a whole lot that hasn't changed. We're just replacing the driver. And what we know about the future is you can't just change one thing, because one thing changes into all these other things. So if you imagine the success of autonomous cars, and you connect it to this idea I had earlier about maybe we don't just own a car, maybe we engage mobility systems when we need them. If you put those two ideas together, you could easily conceive of a world in which humans no longer drive, right? So that the whole environment is free of human chaos and human idiocy. And you could get rid of, imagine, you could get rid of stoplights. You don't have to paint the roads anymore. In fact, you don't even need to have bidirectional roads, right? The cars would just know how to avoid each other and get where they're going in the most efficient way. And if you sort of imagine that future, well, what would have to be true before that could happen? Well, we'd have to have, you know, the technology would have to be good enough. And we know in controlled environments, it actually is already good enough. Mm-hmm. We'd have to have a legal infrastructure. So who owns these things? Who's responsible if they make a mistake? Who pays if there's some, you know, egregious error? But you could kind of work through all those things until you get to right here now today. Here's what I can observe right now. And then logically then, now what that's going to tell you is not a prediction that this thing for sure is going to happen. What it's going to tell you is I'm seeing more evidence. This is becoming more likely. And therefore in my brain, like I've got this memory from the future. Oh, I should pay attention. And so it's a way of training your brain to say what is worth paying attention to and what isn't.
That's an excellent way of putting it. Rita, we've covered a lot of ground. It's been a fascinating discussion. Is there a particular message you want to be sure our audience takes away from this conversation? Anything you really don't want them to miss?
Oh, well, as a leader, I think, you know, you're a human, right? Humans don't like uncertainty. It's frightening. You know, we know what we, even if we weren't crazy about what we had, we know it, right? And so being asked to go think of something that we haven't had yet, and it's completely new and it's completely different, is very scary for a lot of people. So one of the things I think leaders can do is absorb some of that uncertainty. So for today, here are the assumptions we're going to operate on. For today, here's what I need you to be doing. For today, here's how our team is going to work. So kind of create a little cocoon almost of psychological safety and willingness to sort of say, you're in a safe space, you're good. And when the next step comes, we will make it. And I have faith in you and I believe in you. And when the challenge comes, I think we're up to it. You know, that kind of, and you have to be authentic about it, but I think helping people cope with levels of uncertainty that most people have never experienced in their lifetimes is a pretty valuable thing for a leader to be doing.
That's fantastic. Professor Rita McGrath of Columbia University Business School and one of the best thought leaders I know. This was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for helping me and our audience think through this massive transition that we're embarking on. It's been such a pleasure having you. Thank you.
Oh, it's been a delight. Thank you, Marco.
And thanks everyone for joining us today. And please check out the new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.